was Joe Biden for cuts to Social Security before he was against them?
Bernie Sanders realized quite correctly that Joe Biden is extremely vulnerable on Social Security. He has a long track record of advocating for what are essentially cuts to the program.
That's Washington Post columnist Helene Olin. Later in the show, we talk with her about her recent post, Sanders is right, Biden is vulnerable to Trump on Social Security. The conversation covers Biden's record on the issue, as well as the current plans of Sanders, Warren, and Biden to protect and expand Social Security. But first, critics have tried to tar Bernie Sanders with a brush of sexism, implied if not explicit. But some say he could be the first feminist president.
When you bring all of his policies together, that you start to see how the things that cause gender inequality, discrimination in the workplace, sexual exploitation, the devaluation of care work, the intersection of racism and sexism to ensure that women of color and immigrant women are trapped in low-wage work. All of those things really require a new way of organizing society and how we prioritize the things that we think matter in society.
That's Sarah Matheson. We talk with her about her article in The Nation, Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Many American voters, including myself, believe electing a woman president is long overdue. But the interests of women for greater equality, reproductive choice, and a whole host of other issues that disproportionately affect women don't rest on electing a woman for president. They rest on the policies that a president of any gender would promote. Electing a woman president is about representation, seeing somebody like me in the office. Electing a president who will fight for women's rights, including working class and poor women's rights, is about solidarity, benefiting all women. That's the idea underlying Sarah Matheson's December article in The Nation magazine, Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President. I called her up to find out what she meant by that title. Well, Sarah Matheson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Your article, Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President, it was published back in December in The Nation. But it seems here now, a month later, to be even more relevant considering the attacks on Bernie for not being a feminist, for supposedly being a sexist. You say Bernie could be America's first feminist president. What are we talking about when we talk about feminism?
Well, as I argue in the article, what I see in the Sanders campaign is really a feminism that understands that gender equality will not happen without a transformation of society as it currently exists. And so the article was really inspired both by my own historical research for a book that I'm finishing up on reproductive politics after Roe in the US, where I look at some Black socialist feminist organizing around the issue of Black infant mortality in the early 80s that I mentioned in the article, but also by the Sanders campaign itself and its engagement with the Combahee River Collective, which was a Black feminist socialist organization that formed in Boston in 1974, with this understanding that only through a politics of both sort of identity politics, as that collective coined the term, political analysis rooted in their experience as Black women living in the United States, but also a politics of solidarity, one that prioritized coalition building with other marginalized groups, but also groups that understood the ways that capitalism, racism, and sexism work together to impact each of us in distinct ways, but in ways that ultimately harm all of us and keep us from having a better quality of life. So I think that it can be, you know, I will just say that The Nation certainly created a title that was perhaps the most clickbaity of all titles, because I really see this feminism as being espoused by the Sanders campaign as a whole. And I think that gets lost because of the way that we talk about feminism in popular culture and popular discourse. We don't often say what kinds of feminisms we're talking about. We talk about feminism writ large, and that leaves the term vulnerable to being mobilized in the ways we've seen this past week. And that's really why I wanted to bring some specificity to the term that I see the Sanders campaign making possible, and the movement that is behind the Sanders campaign making possible.
You are really talking about the difference between, as you say in this article, between individual success stories and piecemeal reforms versus a systemic approach to oppression. Talk about the difference between representation. I mean, we all would like to have a woman as president. And so by that, I call that representation. In other words, being represented by a woman president as a sign of the advance of women in society versus solidarity.
Yes, I will echo your desire to see a woman president. Given our really dismal track record, that of course is a product of systemic sexism and evidence of the fact that we continue to live in a patriarchal society. But I agree with your use of the term representation versus a politics of solidarity or a politics that understands, foregrounds a systemic analysis of the issues that constrain so many of our lives and determine the constraints and opportunities that are available to each of us. So representation, I think, has been shown to be limited in its ability to bring liberation to the group that is supposedly being, you know, the entire group that is being represented by an individual. A lot of scholars working in Black studies and African American history have discussed the ways, for example, to give sort of a related example, the ways that Black mayors, the entrance of Black mayors into the municipal sphere of politics had a limited impact on the African Americans who were living in inner cities that were really devastated by divestment and an influx of resources into surrounding suburban white areas and removing of resources from inner cities. I would say that we can see similar things when we think about the debate over whether, you know, if we go back to 2016, although I know it can be painful to do so, the debate over whether voting for Hillary Clinton when she was running automatically showed or demonstrated your feminist credentials. And I think there were a lot of feminists, whether they identified as feminists or not, but certainly had a liberatory gender politics as part of their sense of self, who found that to be a sort of pandering and limited way of thinking about how we might bring feminism to and its promises to a wide swath of the population. It seems to me that the Democratic Party has really tried to merge, the sort of Democratic Establishment Party has tried to merge a strategy of, on the one hand, doing sort of this representational politics where gender and racial minorities, a select few, can raise to the ranks of very powerful positions in electoral politics. But on the other hand, that is not really, has not been paired with policies that really support and invest in the most struggling, those who are in the most struggling echelons of society, the working class, the poor, the over-criminalized, the over-incarcerated. And I think what we're seeing now, and even what we saw in 2016, is a realization that that strategy of representational politics without the policies to back up how the lived experience of the most struggling aspects of society are absent from policy initiatives, that strategy is coming apart. And people are really wanting to pay attention to what people say and what they do and what their record has been. And it's not sufficient to just embody a certain aspect or characteristic related to gender.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Sarah Matheson about her December article in The Nation, "Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President." Now, in this article, I think you've just referenced something you call lean-in feminism, which tells women how to elbow their way into the 1%. That's in a society that has extreme income inequality, that's not going to benefit most women. But you also call out Elizabeth Warren to a certain extent, and I wanted to ask you about that, because you say it's also not the feminism that twists past anti-capitalist labor activists, and you're referring to Frances Perkins, who was FDR's Secretary of Labor, into enemies of corruption. What is the point that you're making here? Because I think it's an important one, and yet I think many would say that it is also important to fight corruption.
Yes. Thanks for that. It is definitely important to fight corruption. But I included that part because I was talking with so many people who were saying things like, well, it's really, you know, Warren and Sanders have pretty similar platforms. It's good that we have both of them in the race, because one or the other, supporting one or the other, really amounts to the same thing. And I think that there's a really important distinction there in terms of their respective analyses of how we got to where we are today with such an immense gap between the rich and the rest of us. You know, one of the highest gaps in terms of economic inequality that we've seen in our history. So what that point was trying to say is that, you know, in the simplest of terms, Sanders has stated that he does not think billionaires should exist. He has stated that he believes capitalism is one of the systems that is the cause of our conditions. And Warren has said very clearly that she is a capitalist, that she thinks that if you've worked hard for your money, you deserve to be a billionaire. You had great ideas and you are rewarded for them. And that's sort of the ethic or the ethos of American society. And that we just need to sort of make some reforms or tinker with or reel in capitalism and that at root, what is causing our problems is corruption, as opposed to the overall system. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because to me, that communicates a built-in limitation of what would be possible under a Warren administration. There needs to be a clear line in terms of whose side you're fighting for and whose side you're on, because that makes crystal clear who your enemy is. And it seems to me that the Sanders campaign is quite clear about who the enemy is and understands that a system that necessarily requires exploitation always will, that is built into the system, will result in ongoing inequality. And can we lessen that inequality if we make reforms to capitalism, if we try to rein in corruption or become more punitive towards, you know, abuses of power? Yes, we can. I have no argument with that. But will there always be inequality that remains if that is all we do? Yes, capitalism as a system and its exploitation of created differences, racial difference, gender difference, citizenship versus non-citizenship, its ability to exploit those things entails that there will remain inequality unless we transform the way that we redistribute health and resources and safety in our society.
Yes, and I think at that point, Sarah Matheson, that you just made, leads then right into talking about why it is that women are particularly disadvantaged by inequality. And in other words, yes, men can be poor, but women and children tend to be the larger group that's impacted. Talk now about how Sanders' plans, you know, Warren has plans and Sanders has plans. Talk about the plans that Sanders has that address by addressing profound inequality, actually address the problems of women in general and poor and women of color in particular.
Yeah, I talk about this in a couple of ways in the article. On the one hand, you can see that the Sanders gets criticized in some circles for his universal programs. But I make the case in the article that women have the most to benefit from a lot of Sanders' universal programs. So to take one example to answer your question, we know that women have, one of the reasons that women and children are more impacted by poverty, that they, one reason they comprise the majority of the poor in the United States is because of a dual sort of blow of gender discrimination in the workplace, race and gender discrimination in the workplace, as well as the expectation that women will perform the bulk of childcare and raising of children, which of course is exacerbated by the way that we have left the role of childcare to the private individual. We don't really have a structure or a safety net that acknowledges that childcare is a form of work, that it should be compensated fairly, that everybody needs a structure that will help them take care of their children. And so this is sort of an unacknowledged area of labor that women are trying to perform at the same time that they're trying to perform labor in the productive sphere or in business, in low wage work. And that double whammy, if you will, means that they struggle more and comprise the majority of America's poor. So, you know, Bernie's plan for jobs for all would really benefit women. Bernie's plans to end homelessness would benefit women, particularly trans women of color who make a shockingly high rate of people who are living on the streets. But it's also the way that if you take all of Sanders' proposals collectively, the way that they require us to reimagine entirely what society would look like, that you would actually have security in your job, not only because of a jobs guarantee, but because the Sanders campaign understands that sexual harassment is a primary way that women are forced out of jobs and forced out of the workplace. That housing for all would bring a level of stability to people's lives that we know not only makes it difficult to keep a job, but for children to go to school. We also know that his promise to institute what organizers working in the domestic workers movement have been forwarding for decades around a domestic workers' bill of rights would send a signal that would allow us to rethink how we value the work that is required to keep all of us going, right? Child care, elder care, domestic work, all of these things are jobs that without them, there would be no workforce to speak of. There would be no sort of collective society to speak of. So I think that when you bring all of his policies together, that you start to see how the things that cause gender inequality, discrimination in the workplace, sexual exploitation, the devaluation of care work, the intersection of racism and sexism to ensure that women of color and immigrant women are trapped in low-wage work, all of those things really require a new way of organizing society and how we prioritize the things that we think matter in society. So a couple of ways. In the first way, it's again how I was sort of distinguishing between the gendered impacts or the feminist impacts of a universal program and then some specific feminist reforms that are entailed in the program. So on the first point, we know that, for example, I talk about in the article, Black women age 15 to 44 face the greatest disparity in healthcare coverage. Treating healthcare as a system of profit rather than a system of care and health means, you know, we have to acknowledge that that contributes in important ways to some of the most pressing women's health issues that we are confronting right now. I talk about maternal and child health in the aspect of Black infant mortality in the U.S., which continues to be a health crisis. But we also know that Black maternal mortality has reached very high proportions in the U.S. right now, that Black women are three times as likely to die during or in the year after childbirth as white women. And while there are a number of factors, there's both, you know, lack of access to quality care because it's too expensive. There's coverage that doesn't entail quality care. And there is racism within healthcare. Those things combine, I think, to explain some of these things. But certainly single-payer healthcare would make access a reality in a way that our country has really never experienced. It's not the only step, but it's a necessary and transformative step to say that healthcare is a human right that all of us deserve, that there is no reason that we should have the rates of maternal and child health crises that we do in this country, is a feminist argument, and it's a transformative vision of what society could look like informed by feminist principles. On the other hand, in terms of specific things contained in the bill, some people have written about this, but I'm not sure how widely acknowledged it is, that if we had Bernie's Medicare for All bill and got it through Congress, the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal funding for abortions and has since 1977. Both Democrats and Republicans have sort of treated it as a given, and it's been re-upped every time it comes up. The Medicare for All would essentially make the Hyde Amendment moot. There's a part in the bill that explicitly speaks about reproductive health care and family planning, and single-payer health care would offer us, for the first time, health care that treats both birth control and abortion alongside labor and delivery and prenatal care as health care, as a standard part of the health care that those of us who can get pregnant and have kids are entitled to and deserve without sort of making it a political bargaining chip. So those are a couple of ways that I think Medicare for All is really an important feminist issue.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, Sarah Matheson. In December, she wrote a piece for The Nation magazine, "Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President." So what about the Green New Deal? How is the Green New Deal a feminist issue, feminist program?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll say a couple of things about that. On the one hand, the Green New Deal and the fact that it further evidences the distinction I was talking about earlier between Warren and Sanders and sort of where they point the finger in terms of accountability. Is that, you know, corruption or is it capitalism as a system? And I think the Green New Deal further evidences the reality that we have arrived at the point that we are at because of capitalism's only aim is to produce profit at any cost, regardless of the human or planetary cost. And we are running into this more so than we ever have before, the contradictions of that aim. And so I think that there is an argument to be made that a feminist value system understands that profit is not the thing that we should be valuing, that we should be valuing an investment in the well-being of ourselves, our future generations. We should be investing in the well-being of public goods that benefit everyone in society. And so I think that the Green New Deal forces us to imagine what society might be outside of a logic of just extraction at any cost and endlessly. And, you know, some people have talked about the ways that, to tie this sort of to a question of reproductive rights, some people have talked about the ways that families and individuals and couples are foregoing having any kids, more kids that they would like to have in the face of the climate crisis, and really worried about what it means to leave the future if we don't act soon and with urgency, what that future will look like for their children. And so there are really some really amazing activist projects that tie the climate crisis to questions of reproductive justice, not only because of what the future might entail if we don't take action, but also because of climate-related impacts that we are experiencing in our present moment because of the ways that the impacts of the climate crisis are unequally distributed by race and class, and how environmental racism ensures that frontline communities are the ones who are bearing the brunt of catastrophic climate disaster, as well as the pollution that is a byproduct of the climate crisis. So I think, you know, ensuring that we leave an inhabitable world to future generations is a major reproductive justice issue and aim that is directly tied to the climate crisis. I also think that the Green New Deal really does important work in terms of foregrounding the longtime investment of Indigenous communities and Indigenous wisdom that has been at the forefront of climate activism for so many decades. It not only acknowledges and says that listening to that wisdom and experience will be necessary for addressing the climate crisis, but it also, you know, specifically allocates funds to say that frontline communities, which include Indigenous communities, will be recipients of the repair work that necessarily has to happen and is already in great demand because of where things have gone with the climate crisis. And a lot of people have written about, both scholars and activists, how Indigenous feminism that really foregrounds the role of women in the movement has been central to strategizing about how to try to take on fossil fuel industry and fossil fuel profiteers who disregard Indigenous sovereignty, disregard Indigenous land treaties, have no concern for the environmental pollution that will necessarily impact Indigenous communities. So I see that specific aspect of the Green New Deal as a really important component of highlighting Indigenous feminist wisdom and activism that has so dramatically influenced and shaped the climate movement.
And maybe then it's no accident that so many people who are in the leadership of the climate movement are women.
Exactly. Exactly.
And maybe then it's no accident that so many people who are in the leadership of the climate movement are women.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Sarah Matheson is an assistant professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at George Washington University. Her forthcoming book, Reproduction Reconceived, tells a story of family making in the post-Roe era. And go to writersvoice.net to find a link to her article, Bernie Could Be America's First Feminist President. Next up, Helene Olin on Social Security and the 2020 Democratic Campaign. Stay tuned after the break. Rosie. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. To many Americans, Social Security is a lifeline. The benefit makes up a majority of cash income for 61% of older beneficiaries, and a third of them rely on it for 90% or more of their income. That's according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Without Social Security, they estimate that 15 million more elders would live in poverty. It's even more of a lifeline for women and people of color. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities explains, women tend to earn less than men, take more time out of the paid workforce, live longer, have less savings, and receive smaller pensions. Our guest today, Helene Olin, says it's one of the great feminist issues, like access to abortion, and should be understood that way. Ditto as an issue of racial justice. African American and Latino workers benefit substantially from Social Security. That's because, on average, they have higher disability rates and lower lifetime earnings than white workers. Without Social Security, the poverty rate among elderly Latinos would approach 50%, and the poverty rate among elderly African Americans would be even greater. With all its importance to the lives of most Americans, Social Security doesn't often make it into the headlines. Well, that changed this week when the Sanders campaign charged that Joe Biden's record on Social Security is flawed. Others have suggested Biden's record on Social Security could weaken him against Trump in the general election, including our guest, Helene Olin. Joe Biden says he currently supports expanding and protecting Social Security, but questions remain because of his long history of advocating cuts to the program and praising Republican efforts to do so. And this week, Bloomberg reporter Stephen Dennis reported that Mitch McConnell told him he hopes to, quote, work with the next Democratic president to trim Social Security. So whether a Democratic president will strengthen or weaken the program is a burning issue to many voters. Helene Olin has written many articles on Social Security and Medicare, the most recent appearing in the Washington Post, entitled Sanders is Right, Biden is Vulnerable to Trump on Social Security. Olin is a columnist for the Washington Post and the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, a book we spoke with her about in 2013. Helene Olin, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on.
You've actually written two pieces this year about Social Security and the 2020 presidential campaign. The most recent one is Sanders is Right, Biden is Vulnerable to Trump on Social Security. Now, of course, this came about because now Biden has, I think as of today or yesterday, refused to answer questions about this. But before that, he claimed that a video from his appearance in 2018 at the Brookings Institution was doctored. But you actually said on Twitter that the Biden campaign is still vulnerable, and I don't think you think that that video was doctored. Tell us what your take on this flap is before we get into the issue more deeply.
Sure. The most recent flap is Bernie Sanders realized quite correctly that Joe Biden is extremely vulnerable on Social Security. He has a long track record of advocating for what are essentially cuts to the program. And the reason I say essentially cuts to the program is because nobody comes out and says, I'm going to cut your Social Security check. It doesn't quite work that way. What happens is that people, and Biden, I would consider among them, talk about or hint at things like raising the retirement age, not giving the cost of living increase, which is an annual thing, and so on, which are essentially cuts because it means people are either going to get money later than they otherwise would, or they will receive less money, or both. And those are what we call cuts. So I just have to put that out there for a minute. So in any case, what the most recent flap was is that Bernie Sanders knows quite well that former Vice President Biden has this 30-plus year track record and finally called him out on it. It was one of those things that, frankly, I was sitting around sort of waiting for somebody to do that to happen for the longest time. It struck me as something that was bound to come up sooner or later because seniors do vote. They are a huge part of the Iowa population, and Social Security is a huge issue to them. So what essentially happened is that the Sanders campaign last week started putting out a lot of videos of Biden speaking about Social Security over the years, and including one that was from an appearance in 2018 at the Brookings Institution in Washington that turns out to be a bit controversial because it's not clear if Biden was being sarcastic or not when he was talking about how Social Security could be cut. And different people have different interpretations of this video. Sanders' campaign thinks he was not being sarcastic. A lot of progressive commentators don't think he was being sarcastic. Online fact checkers seem to agree that he was being sarcastic. I have watched the video, and all I will say is I think the old Scott's verdict, not proven, is probably the best description for it. And so anyway, Biden claimed that this video was doctored by the Sanders campaign, which was absolutely not true. And this has sort of set off the latest round of hostilities.
Well, of course, Biden, as you point out, has a very long record of this, talking about cutting Social Security. I think Ryan Grimm was the one who says often it's couched in terms of adjustments. Do you agree with Grimm that adjustment is another word for cuts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Adjustments, you know, there's always these code words. Because as I said, nobody says, I want to cut your Social Security check. And adjustments has been one of the traditional code words that is used over the years. And that definitely turned up in the Brookings Institution talk. And it turned up a moment or two after the supposedly sarcastic quote by Biden. So this is, again, it is just beyond contentious. My point is fairly basic, and this was the point I made in my piece last week, which is that this is going to be a he said, she said, but on one basic level, it's absolutely irrelevant, because the fact is that Biden does have this long track record. He also headed up President Obama's budget negotiating with the Senate, where Social Security was most certainly on the table. He does have this track record. The videos, there are videos galore of this, of him saying, you know, this is tough talk and we need to talk tough on Social Security. Tough talk on Social Security is a very good way to sound very serious in Washington, as Paul Ryan learned. And these things will be used by one Donald Trump, who's currently in the White House. There's no question in my mind about that. Donald Trump, one of the reasons I've always been convinced he was the nominee for president in 2016 when all the other candidates on the Republican side went by the wayside, is that he very early in said, I am not cutting Social Security and Medicare. Whereas the rest of them, as I always say, were basically competing to see who could throw grandma under the bus first. And no surprise, this made him stand out, and it was probably one of the reasons for the initial interest in him by voters. And I think political analysts often miss this because we tend to skew younger. We're not Social Security age, and it tends to be something that's not quite on our radar quite as much, frankly. So anyway, my position is that basically this will come up. Donald Trump is a practice con man. He has, in fact, cut Social Security since. He has, you know, made moves to cut disability insurance, which is part of Social Security. But regardless, his ability to, you know, push through contradictions like that is pretty legendary at this point. And there's really nothing stopping him from, you know, running this stuff or having some dark money run this stuff in nonstop Facebook loop, targeted at people, say, over 55 or 60. Micro-targeting is a big thing. And it was one of the things that, you know, as we all know, helped him become president in 2016.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because, you know, I mean, Donald Trump himself, of course, as you just pointed out, is quite vulnerable on the issue of cutting Social Security, since he already has, and he has proposed it, and he has proposed cutting Medicare as well as Medicaid, which, by the way, Joe Biden has also proposed to cut, or at least to freeze, I think is what he called for in the past. So what you're saying is that the ability to use this kind of micro-targeting to voters who may be, you know, fairly low information, who aren't following things, is really the way that Joe Biden is now vulnerable to Trump doing those kinds of targeted ads.
Exactly. He's extremely vulnerable to it. People don't quite realize what Trump has been up to. I recently wrote about this through the prism of Medicare as well, where he is, you know, definitively trying to make changes that would, you know, essentially increase privatization within the program, which over time would make it less effective for many older Americans. But he's presenting himself as a champion of Medicare, and you really need to get into the weeds to understand what's going on there. And it just strikes me as competing with one hand tied behind your back if the Democrats are going to nominate a candidate who is extremely vulnerable on these issues.
Yeah, and now let's talk a little bit about how important Social Security is. I think Joe Biden made the point in one of his the things I saw quoted with him is that most of the people he knows don't depend on their Social Security, but a whole lot of other people do. Who does depend on Social Security?
Most older Americans is the basic answer. We know, I mean, people calculate it slightly different ways, but we essentially know that minus Social Security, older Americans today, 50% of them would be living in poverty or near poverty, minus it. It is a huge chunk of their incomes. For women, you know, roughly 20% are dependent on Social Security for the vast majority of their income. For African Americans, that's 50%. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a program that, and I should say that women, as a rule, are more dependent on, and they receive less from it. At all points, the majority of recipients for Social Security are female. By the time people are 85 to 90, it's over two-thirds, because women outlast men, as a, you know, as a rule, and they live longer. And at the same time, they receive less money from the program, because women earn less, because women tend to be in and out of the workforce, because women are responsible for caretaking, and so on down the line. So, you know, there's huge vulnerabilities among the population should Social Security be cut back. And a few years ago, one of the advocacy groups calculated that if there was a change of the cost of living formula to make it less generous, that it would ultimately, by the time a woman is in her late 80s to early 90s, would cost her about a week's worth of food, which you don't think about. And again, it's mostly a female problem at that point. I've often said that one of the great misunderstood issues out there is that Social Security is actually a feminist issue, and that a tax on it should be understood through the prism of the war on women in the same way abortion is understood in that way.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Washington Post columnist Elaine Olin about her recent post, "Sanders is Right, Biden is Vulnerable to Trump on Social Security." And a feminist issue, and also an intersectional one, because as you pointed out, Black seniors also rely on Social Security, you know, half of them, for their primary means of support. So talk about that double whammy that is faced by women of color, older women of color.
Yeah, they are extremely dependent on the program. These are groups of people, as a rule, who, as I said, do not have a lot saved for retirement. And I should say that that is a situation that's likely to get worse, not better, because a combination of two things. One is the overall population. There's, as we all know, there's been a shift away from defined benefit plans. More and more people are now forced to save for their own retirements. They have less and less money because most people do not save effectively for their own retirements. And that is true of both sexes and all races. But another place where this creeps in is African Americans never have had anywhere near the wealth of other Americans and have suffered massively in the past 10 years and have seen very little, as opposed to white Americans who've actually come back to some extent from the Great Recession. Most African Americans have not. And a lot of this is because for most Americans, we have this idea that the stock market is everything. In fact, for most Americans, the majority of their net worth is tied up in their home, and no group more than African Americans suffered from the real estate crisis.
Now, Elaine Olin, in your article for the Washington Post, "Sanders is Right, Biden is Vulnerable to Trump on Social Security," you do mention Sanders' plan as well, as I believe, and also in the earlier piece that you wrote in February, it actually was about Sanders' plan. I think you say Bernie Sanders wants to talk about Social Security. So tell us about Sanders' plan, and, you know, do you feel that his plan is up to the job of dealing with the issues that we face on Social Security? First of all, the fact that, you know, it is vulnerable, something has to be done to deal with funding it better, and also the fact that there really hasn't been a Social Security raise in a long time, other than just a, you know, small cost of living.
Right, because of changes that took place in the 1990s, Social Security now replaces less income, and I should say changes in how the cost of living formula was calculated. Social Security actually changes, it replaces a smaller percentage of working income than it used to. And unfortunately, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, so I need to apologize for that. But essentially what Sanders would like to do is address the issue of the trust fund, which is, as is rather famously known, is going to run out of money at some point in the mid-2030s. This is translated to people as Social Security is going bankrupt. For the record, this is completely and utterly untrue. Social Security can be funded out of general revenues. And even if it's not, it would not mean that Social Security is going away. Your worst case scenario would be a reduction in benefits. I'm just putting that out there because people are like utterly convinced that, you know, this means Social Security is a goner by the mid-2030s. Utterly untrue. But anyway, there's lots of ways you can address this. And one of the most easy ways to address this that is never said by the people who advocate getting tough on Social Security is fixing the payroll tax cap on income. Right now, people do not pay taxes on income in excess of a little bit more than $130,000 a year. They also do not pay any Social Security taxes on capital gains and investment income. Sanders would like to fix that and would change that to make it the cap $250,000. And he would include dividends and capital gains in that number. He would also change the cost of living formula to compensate seniors for what are their higher expenses. If anything, seniors experience a higher rate of inflation than I would and do right now because they are disproportionately hit by medical and by housing costs. And finally, he would increase the benefits for lower income Americans. And he sent his plan over to the Social Security's Office of the Chief Actuary, and they said it would stabilize the program's finances for the next half century, which would eliminate a major argument for talking tough and cutting Social Security benefits, you would think, right? And I should say, Biden also has a plan to strengthen Social Security. And he would like to increase the minimum benefit so that everybody receives 125% above poverty line, you know, check every month, basically. And people who've lost a spouse and a few other things. And he would fund it also in part by basically more or less eliminating the payroll tax cap. And Elizabeth Warren also has a really great plan, I should say that as well. So, but the issue with Biden, of course, is do you trust this? Because again, he's got this long track record of advocating for the exact opposite. And of course, he's saying he would like to make a deal with the Republicans. He's still convinced that there are rational Republicans out there who somehow want to, you know, once Trump is out of office, are going to somehow see the light and start working with Democrats again, which is something I've referred to in the past as fantasy thinking for moderate Democrats.
So who do you trust the most to push hard for Social Security reform in a way that increases benefits and the stability of the system?
I should say I do trust all of them at this point, but I particularly like both Sanders' plan and Elizabeth Warren's plan. And I think they're both really great. And I think both have a very long track record of arguing for this. Elizabeth Warren, in fact, probably deserves the most credit for the fact that we are discussing these sorts of things because she threw her support behind a proposal to raise benefits in 2015 and really brought this sort of simmering issue to public attention. And when she did that, it really shifted the narrative away from the 20 to 30 plus years of we need to get Social Security under quote control, unquote. Mm-hmm. And of course, Bernie Sanders as well has advocated for that position for decades, you know, too, I should say. He's been a supporter of buttressing the plan.
You know, I've always been puzzled about this cap. I mean, before we go, how did that come about? It seems like it makes Social Security highly regressive because the more money you make, the less percentage of your income you're spending actually on Social Security. And people who are very wealthy tend to get the highest level of benefits.
I think the idea behind it in part is because, you know, we're not going to give you a Social Security check on par with $1 million income. But one of the things that has happened is that it's actually become a bigger issue over time because of the increase in income and wealth inequality. So that in previous decades, the cap was actually shielded less money from less people from collection, because one of the things about income and wealth inequality that we don't think about is we generally think when we say income and wealth inequality, oh, people have less money. But in fact, more people are actually also sort of towards the top of the pile than in the past. And more people are at the bottom. It's the middle that has been squeezed out. And over time, that has actually cost Social Security significant money.
And those people at the top have shielded far greater amounts of income as a result of the tax cap being so low.
Right. And as a result, less money is going into the trust fund.
Well, Helene Olin, this has been really great to talk with you about this really important issue, I have to say, not just important for seniors, but important for their families, because, you know, whatever seniors don't have, then the burden falls on the families. And for future seniors. As you point out, Generation X is going to be in worse shape even than the current generation of seniors.
Yes, and I want to thank you for pointing both of those things out. One of the arguments I frequently make with Social Security, because none of us really want to see ourselves as getting older, is that we are going to, if your parents don't have Social Security, that falls on you most likely. One of the things I often point out to people is I think we have this idea that in the past, everybody saved and everybody sort of took care of their family. But actually, that's not true. And one of the reasons we have Social Security is because in the past, older people had this distressing tendency to like end up in like things like called workhouses back in the 19th century because their families wouldn't take care of them. So this is a really important point I like to make, but in other times it would really strain the family to have to take care of an older family member who wasn't no longer working. So this is a really important part of our history, and it's often one we don't think that much about. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other thing is that you mentioned, and I do need to say this and thank you as well, is that Gen X is not 20 years old any longer and sitting around coffee shops listening to Kurt Cobain, who, as I pointed out recently to somebody, would be in his 50s if he was still alive. So, you know, this generation is rapidly approaching the years where Social Security isn't just going to be an issue for their parents, but it's going to be an issue for them as well.
And an issue in the presidential election. At least we hope it will be. Thank you so much, Helene Olin. It's just been great to talk with you here.
Thank you for having me on.
Helene Olin is a columnist for The Washington Post. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our 2013 interview with her about her book, Pound Foolish. Next week on Writer's Voice, we play what we had originally planned for this week, before the headlines got in the way. That's our interview with Michael Clare about his latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.